Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and thanks to Kai Wright, Ilya Meritz, and Dr. Christina Greer for filling in last week. To be perfectly honest, folks, it was really frustrating for me that I had a scheduled week out of town for exactly those days when such a pivotal event for our country as Charlottesville and its aftermath happened. But thanks again to Ilya and Kai and Christina for filling in and stepping up on a historic week. And history is not over, so let's dive back in. Steve Bannon left the White House Friday afternoon. We'll get to that. But one of the most important moments from last week may turn out to be this statement from Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, the widely respected chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, who tends to be measured in his speech. He seemed to imply the possibility of a removal of Donald Trump from office eventually, based on the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. Now, if you don't know, the 25th Amendment gives the president's cabinet or some other body designated by Congress the power to submit a written declaration to congressional leaders that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. In that case, the vice president will take over, the Constitution says. That's the 25th Amendment. So here's what Corker said that has started a round of 25th Amendment speculation.
The president has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence that he needs to demonstrate in order to be successful. And we need for him to be successful. Our nation needs for him to be successful. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat, we need for our president, the world needs our president to be successful. He also recently has not demonstrated that he understands the character of this nation.
So besides not understanding the character of this nation, Senator Bob Corker said at the beginning of that clip, the president hasn't been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence in order for him to be successful. Stability and competence. Well, that doesn't quite fit the unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the wording of the 25th Amendment precisely, but it leans in that direction and raises the question of whether the Republican Congress is seriously beginning to wonder about it. And in that environment, the president is going to give a nationally televised address tonight on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Maybe he'll order U.S. troops to fire bullets dripped in pig's blood at the Taliban, like he suggested last week in repeating a false story about General Pershing in the Philippines. But in any case, a president labeled unstable and incompetent by the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is about to announce a new war policy. I assume we will carry it live at 9 o'clock tonight. My first guest today has been writing interesting and important articles. Interesting and important article after interesting and important article, I dare say, since Charlottesville. He is Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamel Bowie, who also happens to live in Charlottesville. Jamel, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
What do you make of Senator Corker's remark, first of all, and does it suggest a 25th Amendment exit strategy for Congress from this presidency, or is that a stretch?
I think that might be a stretch. It's not clear that there are very many Republican lawmakers who would be interested in doing that. And that's because removing Trump, even if you get Vice President Pence as his replacement, essentially is such a major event, is such a historic event that it slows everything to a halt. If Republicans had any hope of getting their agenda through, it disappears. Once they take that step, they essentially have to wait for another presidential election to have the kind of perceived mandate to move forward. So I just don't see that happening. But it is remarkable that Senator Corker, who is by no means a moderate, he's a conservative senator, has essentially implied or suggested as much that, you know, removing Trump might be the right thing to do. And it is true that among congressional Republicans, there is growing uneasiness. There is a sense that President Trump just is not ready for the job, and that they feel boxed in by circumstances.
And I'll just say one other thing about the 25th Amendment, and that's that it gives the power of removal to a majority of the cabinet. That's what we usually hear when we hear anything about it. But it also says, quote, or of such other body which Congress may by law provide. So it sounds like Congress could pass a law if they think the situation becomes extreme enough with Trump's mental health, or call it what they will, that establishes a group of psychiatrists or I don't know who, and they don't even need the cabinet. So maybe this is fantasy and science fiction and belongs in that department of the library, but it's there in writing.
Right, right. They do not need the cabinet. If a large enough majority of Congress decided that it was absolutely urgent to remove Trump, they could do so. I myself just don't see that really in the horizon. I think the most likely outcome for Trump is that he'll serve out his 4 years.
One of the fears about Donald Trump is, as you know, that he is so self-involved, he could actually start a war to show how strong he is and distract attention from Russia and the bigotry talk to keep shoring up his base. Are you at all afraid we'll hear a version of that tonight regarding Afghanistan, but even more so regarding Pakistan, which apparently is going to be part of the speech and that we're not at war with officially? Obviously, there's interplay there with the Taliban crossing the border. Or do you think the generals, Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, are ironically cooler heads than the civilian leadership and are sufficiently in charge when it comes to this?
That's difficult to say. Donald Trump's instincts kind of go all over the place. He doesn't really have a firm foreign policy doctrine, but his instincts basically seem to lean towards only intervening in a conflict, only starting a war if the United States can get something directly out of it, which makes me sense that we may not see any kind of new intervention or open intervention in the Pakistan. But it is, I think, clear that the generals in the Trump administration have been an influence essentially in keeping Trump close to the status quo in Afghanistan. And so my guess, my supposition is that this address tonight, the president will essentially announce a more hawkish version of the status quo, but something that is basically still within kind of the bounds of what we've been doing in Afghanistan for the past 16 years.
One of your interesting and important articles from this week, and my guest is Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamelle Bouie, was on an issue I've been thinking about too, and I think hasn't gotten enough attention, called "The GOP Can't Hide from Charlottesville." And you wrote, even as the party rebukes Donald Trump's remarks, it continues to enable his racist policies. Can you take a minute and describe the disconnect you're seeing?
Sure. So it's beyond clear that most mainstream Republicans not only denounce what happened in Charlottesville, but criticize the president's sort of tepid and equivocal response on Saturday and then again on Tuesday. But this disconnect, as you put it, is between those condemnations of racism and white supremacy, which came from across the Republican Party, and the extent to which Republicans on the state level and national Republicans have been sort of inert in the face of policy decisions that I think you can fairly describe as racist. So, for example, Republicans on not only Republicans on either level of government not done anything to reverse voter suppression laws, strict voter ID, drastic cuts to hours and access, unequal cuts to access, as we've seen in states like North Carolina and Alabama. But they've been supporters of them. They are the drivers of those policies. Republicans have been largely silent in the face of what independent scholars describe as a wave of voter suppression. And there's a very simple solution to it, kind of create a new formula for preclearance under the Voting Rights Act, but Republicans have shown no appetite for doing that.
So it raises a profound question, and that is, does it have any functional meaning to denounce the philosophy of white supremacy if you're pursuing policies like voter suppression, mass incarceration, Obamacare repeal, et cetera, that structurally exacerbate black white inequality. And we can go back, you know all this, we can go back to Nixon's Southern Strategy after the civil rights laws were passed, the George H.W. Bush campaign's Willie Horton ad in 1988, even while they denounced white supremacy as a philosophy. But it's still important not to wink at the supremacists like Trump did, right? Or for Republicans to denounce him for doing so. Is it, I mean, if the policies might as well be what the white supremacists are advocating, more or less, you know, other than an explicit ethno state, what's the importance that remains of the denunciations by Republicans that have taken place?
Right. I mean, it is the kind of thing where even if the Republican Party is unwilling to stop voter suppression, even if it was silent more or less in the face of the nomination of Jeff Sessions, who was criticized his entire career for an indifference to enforcing civil rights law, it's still very important to denounce the explicit white supremacists and neo-Nazis, because they are their presence in mainstream life is basically inimical to the idea of like free exercise of politics, free exercise of sort of basic civic life. Their position at its most extreme is that non-whites should be removed from the United States, that the oft-quoted Richard Spencer, what he wants is to make the United States a white ethno-state. And so not denouncing that, not standing firmly against it, not recognizing the implicit violence and implicit threat of violence in the actions of white supremacists and neo-Nazis, that not only that elevates their stature, it brings them closer to the mainstream, and I think it palpably makes life unsafe for their targets.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls for Jamel Bowie, chief political correspondent for Slate, and a political analyst for CBS News. I should throw that in too. We may even get to what he said on the Slate Cultural Gab Fest last week about the Confederate TV series. But you can, we're obviously on a wide range of related topics here, and you can weigh in on any or ask Jamel a question on any of them. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Jamel, why is this happening now, by the way, with respect to the monuments? I mean, these monuments to treasonous generals who fought a war against the United States for the right to enslave people have been up since the Jim Crow era. The push to take them down didn't crest in the 60s with the civil rights movement or the 80s or the 90s. It's happening now in 2017. Why do you think?
That's a really interesting question, because you can kind of point to a bunch of different reasons. The first is simply the country is becoming, or at least some parts of the country, just becoming more aware of the historical circumstances behind those statues. And I think the rise and influence of a movement like Black Lives Matter over the past several years has really made that history more acute for a lot of people. So there's just more discussions and more kind of analysis of that. The role of the Confederacy in American historical memory is changing. Historians have long since abandoned the view that the Confederacy was anything other than an effort to preserve and expand slavery. But it's only been the last 15 years when that's really beginning to trickle down into popular culture, and I think that is prompting new discussions. And then especially, I mean, most of these are in the South. They're not all in the South, but most are. But the South is changing. The South, especially in places like Virginia, which is where Charlottesville is located, in states like South Carolina, Florida, North Carolina, these are becoming more cosmopolitan states. They are becoming more diverse states. Even if they're not becoming necessarily more politically liberal, the kinds of people who are calling themselves Southerners aren't just white and black anymore. They're Asian, they're Latino, they're South Asian, so on and so forth. So I think Southerners of many stripes are trying to craft a public memory, historical remembrance that is inclusive, that includes everyone, and that stand that it can the Confederate statues really are they really do stand in the way of that. They represent a white South in a traditional quote unquote traditional white South. Where whites were the dominant social and political group in the region.
Related to this, Jamel, let me replay one moment from Trump's infamous Tuesday news conference. And nobody wants to hear it again. I don't want to hear it again. But I want you to deconstruct part of it. And I want to preface this by acknowledging that the polls that have come out since, and this is kind of new over the weekend, I think, seem to show that maybe very little has changed. The media huffs and puffs, and now he's really done it. Now he's really cooked his own goose, like after Access Hollywood and the Khan family and Judge Curiel, and we only call McCain a hero because he was captured. But no in those cases. And apparently, no now. 67% of Republicans think Trump got it about right on Tuesday when he said this.
You're changing history, you're changing culture, and you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally, but you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly. Now, in the other group also, you had some fine people, but you also had troublemakers, and you see them come with the black outfits, and with the helmets, and with the baseball bats, you had a lot of bad people in the other group too.
So Trump on Tuesday, Jamel, two different things about that clip. One is the beginning, where he explicitly defended the Confederate statues and said, "You're changing history and you're changing culture." That was Tuesday. Then on Thursday, he tweeted, "Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments," unquote. That was even worse than what he said on Tuesday in that respect, right? So these monuments to white supremacy are beautiful, or he's respecting white Southerners' respect for something in their history that they don't agree with anymore, but that happened on their ancestors' behalf. Can there be a range there, in your opinion?
A range as
to a range what? That it's not, you know, you don't have to be a white supremacist to say the monuments and the statues should stay up out of what some white Southerners today who would clearly denounce slavery and the Confederacy and white supremacy as issues that, you know, they believe in today or values that they believe in today, but that would like to see the statues remain out of respect for something in their history that they don't agree with anymore, but that happened on their ancestors' behalf.
Right. I mean, I'm not necessarily sympathetic to that view, but I understand where it's coming from, especially for, you know, people in their 40s and 50s and 60s, for most of their lives, there's been no real, as far as they could perceive it, no real debate over these statues. There's the still potent influence of the myth of the lost cause, which does not, you know, may not condone the fact that, or even acknowledge that men like Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson fought in a cause for slavery, but heralds their virtue, heralds their value, their valor, treats them as sort of figures worthy of moral respect. And it makes people uncomfortable to take those down because they may not agree with the cause, but they may see Robert E. Lee as like a fundamentally decent person whose example is worth, excuse me, is worth emulating.
That's right. If you need a minute, I'll take a call. You need a sec? All right, why don't we take a call? And my guest is Jamel Bowie, chief political correspondent for Slate, who is having a moment as a guest, as all professional radio hosts have. Like, oh my God, I have to keep talking, but I'm having a coughing fit. What do I do now? And Jamel, remind me to get, before the end of the segment, to how Charlottesville itself is doing, since you live in Charlottesville. Are students going back to the University of Virginia, classes are about to start, and otherwise, how's the city doing, and your take on the TV series Confederate. But Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Thanks for taking my call. So I'm African-American, a native New Yorker, but my mother is from South Carolina. I really think that this initial push against Confederate monuments and that sort of thing is really about the left or progressives not having any real power. They've lost all the institutions. They've lost all the elections. They don't have any. They've been marginalized in the courts. They've only Obamacare was only saved thanks to the Republicans' divisions. But the progressives have no real power, and so they shift onto these cultural issues, these identity issues, as a camouflage, as a way of rallying themselves, because they don't have any real power anymore. And I think that's really what we're dealing with here, and I think it needs to be talked about.
Jim, thank you. Jamel, what do you think? Jamel,
yeah,
are you back?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure that I agree. So in Charlottesville, for example, the conversations about removing the Robert E. Lee statue began several years ago. It's these latest events are kind of a culmination of those conversations. I know in places like South Carolina, where the Confederate flag was taken down from the State House in 2015, that was prompted by the attacks at Mother Emanuel. In places across the South, North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, these conversations have been ongoing. Richmond, Virginia, which has a sort of famous, infamous, depending on where you stand, avenue called Monument Avenue, which has a whole kind of host of these monuments to Confederate generals. There's been debates over Monument Avenue for the past 20 years. So I don't think this is there's a, you know, a term, presentist, in which people sort of like filter everything through the lens of what's happening now. And mm-hmm. I think it's a somewhat presentist view to say that, oh, this is only because progressives are shut out of power on the national level or on the state level. That's not the case in Virginia. Democrats have controlled statewide government for some time, and Charlottesville is a heavily Democratic area. It's not true. That's not true in North Carolina necessarily, where arguments about this were being had when Democrats held control of state government several years ago. So, I think it might be in some cases there's some truth to that, but I do think this is an ongoing conversation, and it's reaching a critical mass now because of sort of broader changes in what the South looks like, and what the South imagined itself to be.
And related to that, a tweet from a listener says, why didn't go after racist monuments earlier? We had much bigger issues to fix back then. Now more balanced, it's time. So that's what one listener thinks. So the other part of the Trump clip that I wanted to get to with you is what I think has more people divided by party in these new polls that are coming out, with 67% of Republicans say, yeah, he actually got it right on Tuesday, and only 10% of Democrats. He said explicitly in the clip, the white nationalists and neo-Nazis should be condemned totally. That was a quote. But you had others in Charlottesville, he said, who were not Nazis and supremacists, just protesting the statue removal. And some of the anti-racism protesters were the, you know, Antifa agitators who came with the intention of doing battle in the streets themselves, like some of the Nazis did. Republican America hears that as a denunciation of white supremacy. Not a wink at it, as well as a statement of fact about the violent elements on both sides. But he gets labeled an enabler of white supremacy. So where are you on this, and are you surprised that the polls seem to say nothing has changed politically as a result of the last week?
I'm not entirely surprised, largely because it's just very difficult for partisan affiliation or partisan attachment to budge at all. One of my favorite little facts is that even at the height of Watergate, upwards of 70-something, mid-70 percentages of Republicans still supported Richard Nixon. I actually think the fact that only two-thirds of Republicans think Trump did a fine job with the response to Charlottesville is indicative of weakness. That's a little low, given how strong partisan attachment is. And I'll say I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. Even if that weren't the case, I'm not surprised that those Republicans thought Trump did a good job. it is, if you're looking to give him the benefit of the doubt, then he had enough, in my view, perfunctory denunciations of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, that you could say, oh, well, you know, obviously he thinks they're harmful, he thinks they're bad. I don't see what the media is freaking out about. And as we spoke about earlier, there are just plenty of people who do not think the monument should be taken down, who see those men as people worth honoring, and who don't understand or don't want to understand the controversy around it, or why they should even come down.
And on him saying the white nationalists and neo-Nazis should be condemned totally, David Duke somehow took that as a wink of approval. A lot of other people, you know, on the left took that as a wink of approval, but his words were, the white nationalists and neo-Nazis should be condemned totally. How do you square all that?
I mean, I think the thing is, you have to consider all of this in the context, of that initial Saturday statement. When he went off script and equivocated between the two groups, the white supremacist protesters and the counter demonstrators. So even on Tuesday, when he, you know, has these asides, you know, you have to, you know, these are bad guys, they need to be condemned. Even on Tuesday, with those asides, it is hard to think that he's being sincere, especially when he is at the same time kind of trying to argue that there was violence on both sides. And it should be said, the even larger context for this, with regard to Charlottesville, is that someone was killed, and that person was killed by someone allegedly affiliated with the white supremacists. So to draw any kind of equivocation begins to look very suspect, even if you are making denunciations of the white supremacists.
Judy in Port Washington, you're on WNYC with CBS News political analyst and Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamel Bowie. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you. I have 2 points, really. One is, I'm concerned that Democrats are being drawn into an untenable position. Republicans are baiting us about the statues. And they go, what's next? Taking down Thomas Jefferson in Washington? And that we'll say, yeah, sure. And that will be too far. And there will be a backlash. So that's one concern I have about this whole discussion. But my other point was just for the program Confederacy that they're thinking about writing.
The TV show?
Right. The one that the Game of Thrones people are proposing. I think it should only go ahead if we flip the races and white people are the slaves. I think that would be very instructive for everyone.
It is amazing that this has happened. This, of course, that TV series was already such a controversy, and now Charlottesville and the attention that it's drawing to the movement to take down Confederate statues, drawing so much more attention to this topic. Jamel, I don't know what you said about the series, and I think it's more than an idea. That series is happening, right?
Right, that series is happening. I want to just say something really quickly about the notion of a slippery slope from taking down a statue of Robert E. Lee to taking down a statue of Thomas Jefferson. So Charlottesville obviously is home to the University of Virginia, founded by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson's Monticello is just down the street from town. It's like a 10-minute drive from my apartment. Thomas Jefferson has a heavy presence in Charlottesville. No one's calling for the removal of a statue of Thomas Jefferson. The difference is that someone like Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson is only honored because of their role in the Confederacy, because of their role in a slaveholder's rebellion. And those monuments were erected, the Robert E. Lee one in particular was erected adjacent a historically black Charlottesville area, historically black Charlottesville business district. They were erected as markers to white supremacy, to white hegemony in the region. There's a reason why they're not non-central areas, that they're next to courthouses, they're in major public squares, they're in places where everyone has to look at them, because they're supposed to stand for the dominance of white Americans over Southern society. That's just not true of Thomas Jefferson, of George Washington. Yes, they owned slaves. Yes, I happen to think that their slave owning should be a larger part of how we remember them. But we don't honor them because they owned slaves or because they participated in a rebellion on behalf of slaveholding, which they didn't. We honor them because of their contributions, not just to the establishment of the United States, but sort of to the establishment of democratic ideals around the world. And so there's good and things worthy of honor within their legacies that we can extract and use to hold them on pedestals, literally. And to make that argument for Robert E. Lee or for Stonewall Jackson, you have to essentially either argue that the causes for which they fought, the reasons we remember them at all, were somehow either not as bad as we think or positively good, or ignore them entirely. And both of those options are untenable.
Is Princeton an example of the possibility of slippery slope? Because you know there's a movement at Princeton. We've done segments about it on the show. I'm sure you've written about it at Slate. To take down Woodrow Wilson's name from things that are named for him at Princeton because of his racist policies.
You know, that's an interesting one, and I've not written about it, and I'm honestly not sure where I come down on it. But I think broadly, so two things. The first is that these debates are healthy. This is how a healthy democratic society operates. Uncritical reverence is, I don't think, good for democratic societies, and it's a good thing that new generations of Americans are looking at the people that previous generations of Americans have opted to honor and celebrate and asking themselves why, and asking themselves if those people do have a place in our national memory. Most of them will remain. Again, no one's trying to take down statues of Jefferson and Washington. And even those that come under criticism, if they remain, we may have better understandings of who they were as historical people. So I think these debates are good. And in the case of Wilson, and let's just kind of extend this to all of these arguments, if what it takes to make the United States a country that more closely fulfills its ideals and more closely fulfills its pretenses towards equality and fairness, if what it takes is to begin removing statues to people like Wilson, even if, you know, if that's what it takes, then I don't necessarily think that's the worst cost in the world to pay.
Last thing, and already over time, but you live in Charlottesville. How's Charlottesville a week later? And how's the university? If people are freaked out as parents from around the state, around the country, you know, sending their freshmen to UVA for the first time in the middle of this or just after this, or even returning students. How's the university? How's the city?
So I've not had a chance to sort of spend much time over at the university just because kids are now just getting back. But I think the city is – it's in the immediate days afterwards, it was definitely shell-shocked. I think now the city is beginning to kind of like come to terms with this new normal. There's still a big memorial to Heather Heyer in downtown Charlottesville where all of this took place. And I think there's still conversations being had and to have. I think what also is true is that both the university and Charlottesville feel more secure in their values. There was a big vigil last week where a lot of people came down to the university, kind of in honor of the victims the injured and killed last Saturday, and kind of as a statement against white supremacy and racism. And it was a unifying moment for the city. And so for as much as a lot of tough conversations have to happen here, a lot of tough discussions about ongoing racism and racial inequality in Charlottesville, and those have to happen, I do think there is a sense that the city is at least somewhat united in moving forward and having those discussions.
You know what? Stay on with me for one more minute because we're just getting a call from somebody for whom this is very personal and I think it says a lot. Janine in Park Slope, originally from Virginia. Janine, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Welcome back. I missed you.
Thank you.
I'm down in Florida. I went to Robert E. Lee High School in Springfield, Virginia, which is something that I normally don't tell people. I'm a military brat, so I usually say, you know, I'm a military brat. I was born in Japan, and I don't say where I went to high school. And even when I was in high school, I graduated in 1988, and I would protest the name on my own.
What was it like for you at the time as an African-American high school student at, of all things, Robert E. Lee High School?
Well, they changed our boundaries. I was supposed to go to West Springfield. And going to Robert E. Lee, I think it's why I work in activism, to be brutally honest, because things that I've been saying for 20 years, I used to protest apartheid. I would skip school to go down to the South African embassy. My mom doesn't know that, but I would go and protest. And it, you know, seeing that flag, and it's still Robert E. Lee High School, and the flag is still there. Growing up in Virginia, having to go to Mount Vernon on field trips, being the only black kid in elementary in my school, and have my bully, who was this little blonde-haired girl, say when they saw the slave quarters, oh, that's where Janine's family would have been, and have the whole class laugh. Mm. It just builds a... And the thing is, black people have been, we coexist with this. My grandfather on my mom's side was a sharecropper, and he used to tell me stories about the Klan. They were my boogeyman. And so Harriet Tubman was my angel, and she still is. So, you know, I think it's telling that it also tells who people are. People say that, you know, everyone's a little racist. I think black people are prejudiced. I think racism is something reserved for those who have the privilege of being the descendants of slave owners, because they still carry that privilege. Now that I'm in the South, being in Florida, in North Florida, where so many people are still connected to the flag. I go to the grocery store, and the trailer by the grocery store has a huge Confederate flag. People have it on license plates. It's on T-shirts and hats and on belt buckles.
How do you understand their relationship to the Confederate flag in 2017, now that you live there?
I don't live there. I'm coming back in October.
Okay.
I think it's their Southern pride. I think this area is very depressed. I think that everyone's been paying attention to poor white people. And I think this is part of their being able to be perceived as having some sort of privilege when they have nothing. There are people here. It's a very depressed area. There's a lot of people don't have jobs. And they cling to this time when their ancestors owned something. And that white skin meant something.
Janine, thank you. Thank you so much for an important contribution this morning. Jamel, I don't know that we can top that with anything, but if you want a 15-second soundbite to wrap it up, go ahead.
No, I'll let Janine have the last word.
Appropriately so, except for that from Jamel Bowie, chief political correspondent for Slate, and CBS News political analyst. Jamel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.